Welcome to episode 156, 156. Joe, how are you doing?
Just fine, Tim. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Well, very interesting week this so far. Couple of some develops. Tonight we agreed to talk about Colored Revolutions and this character, Gene Sharp. But before we get into that, maybe some recent events. Saw today that California are ordered to wear masks in most indoor spaces. I suspect it's one of those cases where they tell you have to wear a mask, but you can probably decline, citing health reasons. But again, the charade continues. California on Thursday started requiring people throughout the state to wear masks in most indoor settings and outdoors when distancing isn't possible. Science shows that face coverings and masks work, declared Governor Gavin Newsom. Said that in a statement about the new order. They are critical to keeping our who are around us safe, keeping businesses open, and starting our economy. So he's on the side of the economy. States including Michigan, New York, Maine, Delaware, and Maryland have statewide mask orders in place. I don't know if that applies to the Black Lives Matter protesters, nor does the social distancing matter, because according to scientific experts, racism is a more dangerous virus than COVID-19. The order came as California broadly reopens its economy. In most counties, people can now shop, dine in restaurants, get their hair done, and go to church, among other things. Thank you, Gavin Newsom. He's a benevolent dictator. Meanwhile, coronavirus cases are increasing, something that the state says was expected as more people get tested. Well, duh. the tests aren't reliable. Yeah, get more positive, a lot of false positives, I presume, but whatever a positive means anymore. But anyway, the order requires people to wear masks when inside or in line for any indoor public spaces in healthcare settings like hospitals and pharmacies, while waiting for or riding public transportation, and in indoor-outdoor spaces when it's not possible to stay 6 feet apart. Until now, the Democrat governor has allowed local governments to decide whether to mandate masks, an issue that becomes politically fraught as some Americans resist orders to wear them. How dare they? Newsom said he issued the order because too many people are going out in public without face coverings as businesses and restaurants and other sectors of the economy reopen. We have a similar order here in Virginia, and of course I've ignored it every opportunity I've had. It's ridiculous. It's insulting. This charade of the... It's weird because now I can sense that there's a public weariness and fatigue with the crisis with the COVID-19. They've stirred up a race war to transition us into the next phase of crisis mode. So even as they claim that cases spike, there could be a second wave. This isn't the same amount of buzz or interest in this anymore. Everyone's grown bored with it. And like I said, if the media doesn't cover it, it just goes away. I suspect it will evaporate and they'll come up with something else perhaps. But I just read Taco Bell is to announce that it's going to let its employees wear Black Lives Matter masks. Taco Bell says that workers may wear Black Lives Matter merchandise after a video went viral. A former employee at the fast food chain who said he was fired for wearing a face mask with the slogan. Denzel Skinner, who worked at the Taco Bell in Youngstown, Ohio, said in a Facebook Live video that he was dismissed for wearing a mask with a Black Lives Matter slogan on it. Taco Bell said Thursday it was deeply upset by the incident. Denzel Skinner should never have been put in that position, the company said on Twitter. We believe Black Lives Matter movement is a human rights issue and not a political one. Well, that's funny. It's not a political movement? Aren't they making political demands? It's like, okay. Of course, we've had a couple of Supreme Court rulings. One was this ruling on LGBT ruling that the civil rights or anti-employment discrimination laws apply to homosexuals and people who, I guess, sexual orientation, meaning people who may not identify as the sex they are not, or at least not the biological sex, meaning that someone cannot be fired by this for that. LGBT rights advocates triumphed at the Supreme Court Monday, winning a sweeping decision from the justices that protects gay, lesbian, and transgender employees from being disciplined, fired, or turned down for a job based on their sexual orientation. Two of the court's Republican appointees, Neil Gorsuch and John Roberts, joined the court's Democratic appointees to deliver the surprising 6-3 victory to those arguing for anti-discrimination protection. Of course, this is the same Roberts court, is the same court that created the right to same-sex marriage. So it really shouldn't be that surprising. Obviously, now, I guess a business can't have a dress code for men and women. I don't know what this is going to have for schools, particularly religious schools. Now, an employer must indulge the narcissistic fantasy or delusion of someone, of their demented employees. If you can't discriminate for someone, if you can't discriminate against someone who's acting this way, what can't you discriminate against? I mean, that's, you know. And of course, then you had this today, there's the ruling on DACA. It said Donald Trump cannot rescind an executive order. I think it was a program created by executive order by Obama regarding immigration. And it ruled that Trump couldn't reverse that. I don't understand the reasoning in that. But then again, this does support mass immigration, which is a big part of the agenda of the oligarchs. So we have, you know, more sexual degeneracy, mass migration, weaponized migration being given its imprimatur by the given the Supreme Court's imprimatur on these things. So the Supreme Court, once again, is serving the interest of the oligarchs.
Shock.
Big shock there. So those are the events today. Of course, we had last weekend there was another police shooting in there was a police shooting in Georgia, which was hyped into another case to get everyone upset. There was apparently at a Wendy's, a 27-year-old man was fell asleep in the drive-through section of the Wendy's, and I believe if you watch the video, the film, the camera or the body camera, he thought he was at a Burger King, but he was drunk. He fell asleep in the car. They ended up resisting arrest, fighting, wrestling with the officers, stealing the taser from one of the officers, running away with it, and then pointing at the officer. Then the officer shot. He died at the hospital, and now the officer is being charged with murder, which is, I think, an overcharge because I think for murder you have to have premeditation, and I don't see how you can prove that in that case. But nevertheless, we have this again ongoing war on the police. What happened, which seemed to be declared a couple weeks ago in late May, so it seems to be part of this agenda. This stirred up Black Lives Matter. Black Lives Matter, which up until recently was a marginal group, very controversial, not enjoying much support in the public, all of a sudden was lavished with all the support from corporate America, hundreds of millions of dollars being pledged to it, the Ford Foundation, Bank of America, virtually every Fortune 500 company we talked about this last week is now supporting Black Lives Matter. If you work for a large company and you don't express sufficient enthusiasm for the organization, your job is in jeopardy. Like I read with the Taco Bell story, employees can now wear Black Lives Matter shirts and masks and paraphernalia at work, even though it's a highly controversial political issue, something you may not want at your restaurant. They have the right to do it now, de facto, pretty much, because the corporations have all signed on to the Black Lives Matter agenda. Companies are now being shaken down to provide support for them. It's an old game. It's an old, you know, civil rights grifter operation here, where you shake someone down for donations and you won't get the protests. But this might have something to do with our topic tonight, Joe, which is about Gene Sharp and the idea of this colored revolutions, because an organization like Black Lives Matter appears to be just such an organization that would be supported by, you know, by NGO funding, foundation funding to destabilize a government.
Well, I actually have two little curiosities to offer before we get into color revolution and all that stuff. You know, one of the things I've been like doing research in is the so-called potato, you know, the Irish Holocaust is really what it did. And it's opened up this whole area of the Irish slave trade, which I just had no idea about. It's one of these Masonic projects that don't hit the history book. And so I thought at this time, with so much emphasis on Black Lives Matter, we would do a bit of Irish Lives Matter. And of course, I'm here with Tim Kelly, so.
Really, white lives matter because Irish are really,
Yeah,
really, really white people.
right. But anyway, so the Irish slave trade began actually with King James. they had 30,000 Irish prisoners, and King James sold them as slaves to the New World. This is the King James Bible guy. And they were such a hit that they quickly began to depopulate Ireland. And between 1641 and 1652, 300,000 Irish were rounded up and sold as slaves, particularly into the Caribbean.
This was during Cromwell's reign, right?
It was Cromwell himself.
Yeah.
That piece of work. And so they basically, I mean, just, you know, all of the horror that is used to describe the African suffering are, in fact, is occurring during this whole period to Irish individuals. Families were separated. They auctioned over 100,000 Irish children between the ages of 10 and 14 that they had taken from their parents. These were all the Masons, you know, who had control over Ireland at this time. They were mainly sold into the Barbados and Virginia. And in 1656, Cromwell personally ordered 2,000 Irish children to be taken to Jamaica and sold as slaves to English settlers. And of course, once they had them, these people weren't treated very well. They were sex slaves. And they would breed them with blacks, with Africans, because the idea was is that the color that they produced was somehow more valuable. Get that? Interesting. Hmm. But in any case, so this was the Masonic Irish slave trade, which you know, lasted for 100 years and somehow didn't really get into any of the history books. I was never really, I had to go into all kinds of research states to get all this data. There are episodes that are just too horrific to even really mention, but I think Irish should really start to bring this part of the of their history in more into focus, because, and I'm not, you know, the idea of like getting into a pissing contest with blacks over who suffered more is really not useful here. What I'm trying to do is that this will help people understand that it isn't white people in general that are actually tainted by the historical crime. It's a very clear lineage of individuals, very small group, very identifiable. The Masons, right, with Jewish banking families. These are the groups that are actually orchestrating the Irish slave trade as well as the African slave trade. I know there were, you know, European that were involved in the slave trade. I've actually done some research in that area, but it was by and large a Masonic project. So anyway, that's what I will, you know, put forward. And then the other little bonbon that I was really fascinated by is that a listener of Powers and Principalities, Intrepid, he lives in Seattle, and he went to the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone. He actually walked through Chaz, tip to stern, up and down, and then brought back a report, which was fascinating to me because it was there was details that I was unaware of. I mean, basically, what the Autonomous Zone is, it's Cal Anderson Park. It's a 7-acre park. There are the sides of it where there are buildings would also be in the Autonomous Zone. But by and large, it's simply the park, which has structures in it. The police, the precinct houses would be kitty corner to the park over to one side. And the park was picked, there's no question, as the Autonomous Zone, because it is a complete collapsed and failed entity for civilization. It is basically if you've been following the Seattle's descent into insanity, it's ground zero. It's where the heroin addicts basically have congregated.
Yeah, I've heard the public spaces have been more or less ruined. in the recent years
and
there.
It just absolutely ruined. Now here's a, there was an article written by Amy Jennings, and this was years ago. It was like this 10 years old. And she describes the autonomous zone. The article is entitled Shithole. And she says that Capitol Hill is nearing rock bottom, plagued by public drug use and drug dealing, a problematic park, a dearth of social services, a short staff police precinct, and a mayor who couldn't care less. And then she goes on and she goes, you know, neighbors know what the park is used for. Illicit drugs, blatant drug dealing, misuse of public facilities. People are dying of drug overdoses right on lying on the streets. People steal and beg to get money to buy drugs. So so this is the core of the new nation that's being formed. So our listener who called me up, I actually spoke to him on the phone. What he said is that while he was there, he would estimate no more than 10 individuals are actually seemingly on some kind of payroll. And he says they're completely different. They're not drug-addled whatsoever. They tried to arrange a protest march, you know, to perhaps go break some windows or something, but they couldn't even gather together 100 drug addicts to march with them. So they abandoned the protest. It was actually just they couldn't get enough energy to go and even break a window, and so it just kind of dissolved. He thinks that, and then the residents, because they're so used to a failed culture, you know, they live next to it all the time. He says they don't even know the difference between Chaz and just the normal shithole, you know, that they live in. And it's been going on for just forever. At some point, the city just lost a moral compass and decided they really couldn't do anything about the drug use. And then the listener, he then said that there is some energy. It's on the side of the park that is adjacent to the homosexual section. He said this is where you have, like, you know, you'd have Castro Street in San Francisco. This area would be where the gays live, basically. And he said that they had participated in the protests, but they're not involved now because they're getting ready for the big Pacific Pride transvestite, you know, parade fest. Mm-hmm. That's next week. And he said they're working on their eyelashes and stuff, and they couldn't possibly.
They're trying to get rid of their tan lines or something?
Yeah, they couldn't possibly be bothered to go and break windows. So, I mean, he said it was, you know, I mean, it was because it was fascinating to talk to this guy. First of all, I want to thank him for, you know, communicating to me. But his description was so different because than what the media has showing, because just the night before I had seen this, it was an excerpt from, I think it was CNN, where they were talking about how this could easily spread. And it's a, you know, this, violent and organized political movement, Antifa, you know, and, all of those things, you know, have some possibility. But then to juxtapose that, you know, where they're showing these, you know, kind of athletic, crazed individuals breaking things with just sea of drug addicts, right? That are just, they, you know, when they try to do the march, he says half go in the wrong direction. So it was pretty, you know, I think it gives a more realistic picture of the autonomous zone. And I had the thought, and we talked about this briefly, that if you look at the authoritarian personality, the conclusion in chapter 23, and you can see how they're going to use propaganda and arrows, and you've got all of the Gentile neurosis that had been categorized, and, you know, with, you know, ethnocentric, patriarchal. I mean, all of these aspects of culture, which are now defined as neurosis, And then you have the idea of Eros being, put into, like basically replace these things, right? So this is kind of the finished product. I mean, the other thing is just to take Eros and Civilization, the book, and just kind of walk around Kyle Anderson Park, and you can see how prescient Marcuse was, right? I mean, this really is kind of where everyone came to. This isn't a culture. People will talk, oh, there was drugs use in the 50s. And look, I was there. There was nothing like this. There was order. You couldn't just, inject yourself with heroin in front of children and this kind of stuff. So we've really debased, and there isn't, when you look at like how the media is portraying this, they're portraying this group as basically avant-garde and heroic, right? These are the images you get. The idea of social order, the kind of traditional world that civilization sprang from, that isn't represented at all. It's just given as something that was racist and bad. And so I would say we can see the fruits of the project now. They're in Capitol Hill in Kyle Anderson Park, and it's about time that, we tried to take this thing in a different direction politically.
Yeah, these type of this type of phenomena or this type of groupings are they're all parasitical because they're not self-sustaining. They don't produce anything. They don't provide anything. They can't provide for themselves. Whether it's the utilities or the electricity or the infrastructure that they've squatted on, and so they. What happens is orderly society recedes. They squat, take it over, and it just decays and deteriorates, and until it collapses under its own weight. And so it's just something that they indulge for a little while, so long as mainstream society gets up and goes to work every morning and supports them. I mean, even heroin production requires sober people to refine it and deliver it.
Yeah.
So it's nothing it's not an alternative way of living. It's just a way of dying, that's sold to the people as again as a new age. But it's again it's the end game is extinction. But it suggests that this stuff is kind of being supported. It's whether the media coverage or just the fact that you've noticed that maybe as many as 10 people who don't seem to really belong there, yet they seem to be organizing it or supporting it, and that suggests that that maybe at a higher level this is being encouraged for one reason or another, the same way the counterculture movement was co-opted or managed in the 1960s.
Yeah, Tim, I just wanted to interject. There is no way there's any spontaneity whatsoever.
Yeah.
Zero. This is a completely. If you see the video of the guy with the umbrella being the first individual to break the glass in Minneapolis, to this situation with the organizing the fentanyl brigade to break windows in Seattle. I mean, yeah, of course that you could never. This would never happen spontaneously. This is obviously we're looking at a project for
Yeah.
sure.
And of course, tonight we're going to talk about this character, this Gene Sharp guy. He was born in 1928, died in 2018. So he lived to the ripe old age of 90, if I do my math correctly there. He was an American political scientist. He was the founder of the Albert Einstein Institute, a nonprofit organization dedicated to advancing the study of nonviolent action. And professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth. He was known for his extensive writings and nonviolent struggle on nonviolent struggle, which have influenced numerous anti-government resistant movements around the world. Sharp was born in North Baltimore, Ohio, son of an itinerant Protestant minister. He received a Bachelor of Arts in Social Sciences in 1949 from Ohio State University, where he also received a Master of Arts in Sociology. In 1951, in 1953-54, Sharp was jailed for 9 months after protesting conscription of soldiers for the Korean War. He discussed his decision to go to prison for his beliefs in letters to Albert Einstein, who wrote a foreword to his book on Gandhi. He worked as a factory laborer, guide to a blind social worker, and secretary to A.J. Mustey, America's leading pacifist. Between 1955 and 1958, he was assistant editor of Peace News, the weekly pacifist newspaper, where he helped organize the 1958 Alder-Maston March. The next 2 years, he studied and researched in Oslo with Professor Arne Naas, who together with Johan Galtung drew extensively from Mohandas Gandhi's writings in developing the Satyagraha norms. In 1968, he received a Doctor of Philosophy in Political Theory from Oxford University. Funding for Sharp's research at the time came from, this is from DARPA project of the U.S. Department of Defense. Contradiction there? Okay. I mean, reading this is, you know, from Wikipedia, that just, you know, okay, no comment needed there. Sharp was appointed a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth in 1972. He held research appointments at Harvard University Center for International Affairs from 1965. In 1983, he founded Harvard's program on nonviolent sanctions and conflict and defense, which continued in spirit of its founder, and in 1995 was merged with another Harvard organization. In 1983, Sharp also founded the Albert Einstein Institute, a nonprofit organization devoted to the studies of promotion of nonviolent action against in conflicts worldwide. The Institute has received funding from the Ford Foundation, the International Republican Institute, the National Endowment for Democracy, while some former directors have come from the RAND Corporation and the Ford Foundation. In 2004, the Albert Einstein Institute has lost much of its funding, with income dropping from more than $1 million a year to as low as $160,000 a year. From then on, he was run out of Sharp's home in East Boston near Logan Airport. Sharp describes his sources of ideas as in-depth studies of Mahatma Gandhi, A.J. Mustey, and Henry David Thoreau to a minor degree, and other sources footnoted his 1973 book, The Politics of Nonviolent Action. Sharp's key theme is that power is not monolithic, it does not derive from some intrinsic quality of those who are in power. His fundamental belief is that any power structure relies upon the subject's obedience to orders of the rulers. If subjects do not obey, rulers have no power. In Sharp's view, all effective power structures have systems by which they encourage or extract obedience from the subjects. States have particularly complex systems of keeping subjects obedient. These systems include specific institutions, police, courts, regulatory bodies, etc., but may also involve cultural dimensions that inspire obedience by employing that power is monolithic, the dignity of the office of the president, moral or ethical norms and taboos, etc. Sharp identifies this hidden structure as providing a window of opportunity for a population to cause significant change in the state. Sharp published Waging Nonviolent Struggle, 20th Century Practice and 21st Century Potential in 2005. It builds on his earlier written works and documents case studies where nonviolent action has been applied, presents the lessons learned from those applications, and contains information on planning a nonviolent struggle to make it more effective. Sharp has been called the Machiavelli of nonviolence and the Clausewitz of nonviolent warfare. Sharp's 1993 handbook, From Dictatorship to Democracy, was first published in Burma, 4th edition in 2010. It has since been translated in at least 31 other languages. It has served as a basis for the campaigns of Serbia's Otpor, who also were trained by the Albert Einstein Institute, Georgia's Kamara, Ukraine's Pora. Sharp's writings on civil-based defense were used by the Lithuanian, Latvian, and Estonian governments during their separation from the Soviet Union. The Iranian government charged protesters against alleged fraud in 2009 elections with following Gene Sharp's tactics. The Tehran Times reported, according to the indictment, a number of accused confessed that post-election arrest was pre-planned, and the plan was following the timetable of the Velvet Revolution to the extent that over 100 stages of the 198 steps of Gene Sharp were implemented in the four-year Velvet Revolution. Gene Sharp has been accused of having strong links to the variety of U.S. institutions, including the CIA, the Pentagon, and Republican-related institutions, International Republican Institute, RAND Corporation, and National Endowment for Democracy. So, that's Gene Sharp's contribution to worldwide peaceful democratic revolution. These color revolutions haven't really produced democratic utopias, but they have served the interest of the U.S. government or the Atlantis Zio powers. It's a way, a method, kind of a craft to destabilizing a country, finding its vulnerable points both politically and culturally, exploiting fissures within the society, using covert or indirect funding to fund organizations to stir up trouble in these countries. We've seen that all over the place, and perhaps we're seeing it in our own country today with Black Lives Matter, Antifa, and the civil unrest that we've been witnessing just after the COVID-19 lockdown, which did so much damage to our economy. So what's your take on Gene Sharp and his contribution to what's going on today?
I don't think he contributed anything. It's so hard to know what is real in this world, Tim. I don't believe that, World War I was real because, you look at the Masonic signals, like the date on the Archduke's car when he's assassinated, and you can see that this is fake, that the war was basically something to depopulate Europeans with. And of course, you know my position on World War II and Hitler, that's another just, gigantic population reducing project. So Sharp was brought into the world by one of the arch Cold Warriors, Schelling, I think his name is Thomas Schelling, and he brought him to Harvard. And then Sharp produced really just pablum. I mean, the 189 things you can do to bring about a nonviolent revolution are things like a strike, are mockery. You can mock the dictator. I mean, in other words, they're actually almost asinine. They're self-evident. So you can try all this stuff. Doesn't mean the dictator is going to budge. He talks about nonviolence, and I think this is sort of more interesting to me because he talks about, it's nonviolence is important, but then he says that he defines violence as you have to basically do deliberate violence, like shoot someone, stab them, things like this. He doesn't think that indirect death and agony through the techniques that he talks about is violence. And he's really the one thing that he's probably best known for, he doesn't invent the concept, but it's basically, he popularizes it in our lifetime, is the idea of sanctions. Okay, so a sanction is something that, it affects the economy, but of course it can also bring about death through starvation and misery and all sorts of other things. But he doesn't call that violence, you see. So it's only this very peculiar definition of direct violence, which sort of gives him the bona fides that makes him the darling of the left. He directs his energy on those countries. In other words, he was involved in creating training activists, but these would have been against countries that were thwarting the United States geopolitical priorities. Okay, so in other words, he was working against post-Soviet Belarus, the whole Ukraine and Georgia stuff, the Soviet Union, of course, and then troublesome countries like Burma and Thailand and Yugoslavia. But it's really telling that client states he didn't really participate in. He does now, for example, Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's just the centerpiece. I mean, so Saudi Arabia is not anything that he feels needs to be dealt with. He didn't want to go after Chile with Pinochet. In other words, if you were a U.S. client state, then he didn't really, there was nothing written, nothing, he's just completely fine, evidently, with it. It was all, so really, I mean, there you can kind of see how obvious the whole thing is. It was the people he worked with, I mean, people like Kissinger, for heaven's sakes, they were interested in different ways to destabilize. And in the instability of a nation, then they knew they had chances for basically switching out regimes. And so this is what happens time and time again under this guy's, you know, kind of his philosophies. The color revolutions all claim to owe, you know, kind of a tradition to Sharp, but they don't, you know, nothing is very clearly defined because, like I said, the 189, you know, attributes that you can use are all sort of pablum. They don't really mean much. And what really works is just violent overthrow where, you know, like in the Ukraine and places like that. And so, you know, he was set up by the agency, by the, you know, the cold warrior class in Harvard. He produced the philosophy of nonviolence, but it was never outside of the auspice of U.S. CIA geopolitical, in interests. And so when you hear him now being mentioned as someone who is providing philosophy for Antifa or Black Lives Matter protests, well, first of all, I mean, it's just preposterous because these protests are always violent, it seems to me, right? I mean, they're the trademark of these protests is broken windows and, and bricks thrown through things. Mm-hmm. So I don't really understand why they would claim this sort of tradition of nonviolence. It's just the opposite. So I think he's, I think Sharp is... he's good to understand in the sense that you can see nothing is real in this world. You know, the color revolutions, all of these supposedly bubble up resistance against post-Soviet, dictatorships. They were all controlled, right? They were all fomented by probably people inside the United States that wanted to get rid of these dictators. And so we here in the West, we think of these people that they overthrew as evil. But, you know, it's sort of like the moral picture we have of what goes on in the autonomous zone in Seattle. And it just depends on what the media gives us. Nothing that we have in history, in my opinion, is real, Tim. It's all propaganda. And so his nonviolent, you know, so-called approach to regime change is just how the media characterizes it and how the movement characterizes itself. But inside of all of it, I mean, it's just a world of CIA activity, skullduggery, and the people are always fooled. You know, it's just, this is the sad thing. When you read about Sharp and you read about the relationship between him and these movements, the color revolutions, you can see that in every case, the public was fooled. They wanted to set up a more democratic world for themselves, but at the end, they end up with just more influenced by the Masonically controlled countries.
Yeah, there's an article I read about him by Stephen Karaganovnik, Gene Sharp, CIA's Color Revolution Guru and Fraud. He starts out, Gene Sharp, Radio Free Europe praises him as the Karl von Clausewitz of nonviolent warfare. For those who still live under a rock, Radio Free Europe is an old propaganda arm of the U.S. government created with the purpose of destabilizing the Soviet bloc, now retooled as an asset of America's hybrid war across the globe. And he continues, let's see here. Students who are considering enrolling in his democracy school should be reminded that Gene Sharp during his lifetime may have been a charlatan, but for all that, his teachings have not remained entirely barren. They indeed have yielded certain fruits, albeit not those which the mentors promised or harebrained acolytes expected. The actual results range from economically, socially, and politically devastated lands, such as Serbia and the Ukraine, which slowly but surely are sliding into ruin and South American-style dictatorships, to the general breakdown of Georgia under the leadership of an imbalanced pro-Western puppet, Shakashvili, to mention just a few more conspicuous examples. The fate of these and other unlucky countries Czechoslovakia is another example, selected for Sharp's treatment and subjected to the incessant blows of his local mercenary NGO Conotieri, financed mostly by George Soros, be it noted, has surely been dismal. For fairness sake, however, it needs to be pointed out that in terms of the end result, which is the destruction of non-conformist anti-imperialist regimes, the application by itself of Sharp's subversive technology is not all it's cracked up to be. It's just a component of a larger menu of offense mechanisms which are used in concerted fashion to achieve the overthrow or implosion of a recalcitrant government. Without ample supplies of Soros cash to fuel the enthusiasm and avarice of Sharp's street infantry, international media satanization isolation of the targeted country's leadership, financial and economic destabilization and pressure brought about from abroad, as well as patient long-term intelligence recruitment and corruption of key domestic figures and institutions well in advance of the official launching of the color revolution, little would have been accomplished just by following Sharp's supposedly brilliant strategic injunctions. Without state sponsorship, Gene Sharp's Albert Einstein Institute and its inspired teachings would have gotten exactly nowhere. Sharp is a fraud. That's kind of making your point.
It
gives sort of a philosophical, ideological gloss or patina to, you know, subversive activities, destabilization efforts that are brought about by people, mercenaries set in to, you know, stir up violence, destabilize, bribe people, you know, compromise governments. So it's got nothing to do with real ideology. That's just like a cover for it, maybe to sell to the public that there's colored revolutions going on, democracy, there's an Arab Spring, right? There's democracy's blooming in Europe, in Eastern Europe, in the post-Soviet era. But the question is, now for the United States, what we've been, you mentioned, you know, street violence and these things. Now here, recently, we've had the recent civil unrest late spring. It's not, I don't suspect that these are spontaneous. And to what extent are what we're witnessing now, is this kind of the same thing where there's an ideological or philosophical justification for street violence that's meant just to stir up trouble, create turmoil, weaken the regime, if you will, create civil unrest to, you know, bring about a justification for martial law, a new government, even if your ambitions are just electoral, meaning all the Democrats doing this just to win elections in the fall. At one level, that might be their reason for participating. But we've been subject to 3 months of terror because of the lockdown and the COVID-19 pandemic, supposedly. And the local economies were ground into the dirt. The economy was shut down. And then we're still reeling from that. Then as we begin to emerge from this thing, as governors are reluctant to relinquish the powers they seized during the crisis, we have this breakout of protest violence and rioting because of the incident with George Floyd. Now, just in a matter of days, the big issue is now is police reform and defunding the police and police violence, when just a week before, the world was in the grip of a worldwide pandemic. It just doesn't seem to make much sense. But it's almost like as soon as the media switches gears, the reality changes. All this demand, all this protesting, is this, again, a product of the deep state? Is this, are there agents of discord acting within the state governments, even in the federal government? But we've seen governors, mayors, police chiefs kind of stand down. Here in Virginia, the governor has stand down, let public property be destroyed to encourage the rioters. One person, I think, was gravely wounded tearing down a statue. But nevertheless, the police were told to stand down, and the governor said that he wasn't going to protect the property or the statues, which is a violation of his oath of office. And then we had this spate of iconoclasm where now the South and Confederate symbolism, all this is being targeted, and seems to have been a war declared on whiteness, or at least white America, despite the fact that it's, you know, more than two-thirds of the country still. But everything white is being targeted, and white people are being told that they must bow and submit, or show, I guess show their loyalty, their fealty to Black Lives Matter. Corporations are lavishing this organization with hundreds of millions of dollars of funding. The Ford Foundation is involved in this. It seems to be like total war has been declared culturally on heritage or white America, just as we're coming out of a this pandemic crisis. Now, of
Right.
course, decades and decades of social engineering and brainwashing actually is a part of this, but it seems to be they've entered in a particular critical phase.
Yeah, because we're at our weakest moment. And so this is why they now are trying to basically complete the weaponized integration project to completely remove all political power, even aspirations of political power, and just have the European American accept a kind of indentured servitude, to use an expression. I mean, that's really what the Masonic rulers are doing here. They're maneuvering the black lumpen proletariat into street protests. The political class is being forced to stand down, leaving sort of white citizens undefended, both, physically because the police are gone, and culturally because there is just a 100% screaming media that's focused upon them as racist, right? So they're basically defenseless, and this is not a condition that can last for very long. I mean, already you can imagine basically kind of a more militarized response. I mean, we were talking before the show, and you were talking about a militia that basically had come to defend a monument, and they were attacked. The individual who was attacked and shot and killed someone, and then that individual, now even though he was being attacked, is facing charges, whereas the people who were the mob that was attacking him has just been permitted to go free. Well, where does this go? I mean, this will lead to it'll lead to civil wars, what they have in mind. So there's going to be, they're stirring the pot in such a way as to create a civil war, in my opinion. They want basically they're forcing the whites to have no option other than to use weapons in order to protect themselves. This is kind of, I mean, basically the whites in America are sort of feeling, I think, like maybe the Boers were feeling in South Africa after the nationalization of everything, where they were just second-class citizens and they just had to defend themselves as best they could. However, here we are the majority. We, of course, own, quite a bit of property, though nothing, no banks. But
No. Well, that's a function of the lockdown and the economic repression,
right. And but in any case, we have weapons. And so what I think they are insisting upon right now is for us to defend ourselves, and then that will give them the rationale to basically come in with full-scale martial law, and then you'll have the hard lockdown. Where it's like Holodomor, where they can just starve you out because only people with permits can be on the street. So I mean, it's a grim picture, but that's where I think we're at right now. I think the key is try to, if we can, get ahead of the curve, and basically just by organizing ourselves and exposing this process that we're in. And that's why, someone like Sharp that we're talking about, I mean, really, if when you look at the methods of nonviolent protests, like he talks about, I'm just going to read something, you can see how insipid it is, like public speeches, letters of support, signed public statements, group or mass petitions, banners, posters, leaflets, there's a novel, newspaper and journal articles. How about good old skywriting and earthwriting, right? So this is absurd, and I mean, but the point is that it just exposes him as someone who worked to develop a kind of revolution that could be controlled, and that's what's the concept that's important, and that's why I hope people, you know, take this to heart, is that they've done this so many times in the past. You know, they've maneuvered Europeans into slaughters, right? World War I, World War II, the Civil War, you know, the Vietnam War. Over and over again, these events are structured so that we end up just getting, you know, our population reduced. And I think that this is really what they do. This is kind of what their consistent game plan is, to get us off of the planet. And so when you look at this, with the situation we're facing today, we'd be crazy not to think of it as part of the, it's just another one of these events. This one is worldwide, and it'll end up with a worldwide dictatorship if they can, you know, make it work. But it'll also mean with a world without Europeans, you know. So we need to very quickly organize ourselves, and both not just to defend ourselves, which we need to be able to do, but also to try to get some political power, because right now we really don't have any. I think people thinking that Trump is going to, you know, is has some kind of mystical struggle going on with deep state characters. I think you're being played with that one. I know he tweeted out on Vigano's letter a week before this, but that doesn't mean anything. You know, he could show leadership at this moment and really bring these facts to the public, you know, about the Masonic evil that Vigano talks about, but he doesn't. And so that, you know that this is just, you know, it's a charade or being played. So anyway, I think the more people are aware of the process we're in as something that is another one of their projects, Tim. It's just like, you know, think of World War I, you know, the Archduke's license plate. You know, this is just a project. It's very well thought out. You know, the pandemic is an incredibly perfect enemy, right, for the world to fight. You know, they have just got this, you know, well, you can't talk. You have to wear a mask. You have to stand apart. You know, you can't assemble. No, the church groups just can't possibly get together. I mean, everything has worked out so that the public cannot organize itself. This is just amazing, isn't it? How everything is organized in that fashion. It just
now for like Black Lives Matter is allowed to protest and amass in large groupings and ignore the social distancing rules, because as that signed letter said, that racism is a more deadly virus than COVID-19. So it's a greater health crisis.
So this is our situation, is our population is being reduced. It's a war. We're being attacked. And just like the groups that Sharp developed to topple dictatorships, the public is not aware of the, you know, the organizing principles. We just don't see them. And so this is the time when the independent media has to really raise its voice. And we have to start recruiting en masse into the new intellectual army, the army that knows what's happening. You know, that this will be how we'll be able to defend ourselves, is when, you know, we get to this tipping point of, I don't know, 30% would be aware of this and understand it. Then, you know, you can't do things like, you know, beast vaccinate everybody. You see what I mean? It just, mm-hmm. If you get an active component that's resisting, that the current kind of attacks won't succeed. And then hopefully we'll also be able to unify all the different components, you know, because we're scattered to the wind at the moment. I mean, the most unified is probably the Catholic conservatives. You know, I mean, they haven't really stepped up to the plate here with the COVID-19 thing, but they still exist. I mean, I'm talking about the Knights of Columbus and the Catholic background people that would relate to Vigano, right?
Yeah.
Because you've noticed there was a whole bunch. It wasn't like he was alone. when he brought out the letter, when he talked about the Masonic project for world dictatorship, he had about at least 10 or 15 high-level Catholic bishops, you know, come forward and support him.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I wrote in the Facebook declaration that I had seen this and someone showed to me. I said, what Vigano should do is he should declare the Pope as a Masonic tool and illegitimate and simply say, you know, at this time of crisis, I'm going to now take control of the Catholic Church. All righteous Catholics need to basically organize themselves into groups that can defend against the attack that's going on right now. He should really just step up to the plate and take control. And he should ask, like we talked to the other time about the Italian military guy he has this orange revolution that they're trying in Italy, which is a protest against the fake COVID lockdown. That's who Vigano should look to for allies. And then in the United States, the first, you know, kind of chain that can be formed, I think, would be through Christian groups. They would be the ones would be most able to have organizations that could put, you know, communicate and resist. College students, I mean, from then it's just the sky's the limit, because once you have a few million who are involved in the project, who will no longer be cowed down by racism, by charges of anti-Semitism, by anti-socialism because you won't wear your mask at Trader Joe's, I mean, this kind of crap.
Mm-hmm.
Then if you get a couple million of these guys that are just, I've had it, we're not going to go quietly, we're going to fight. They just, this stuff will, because you see, once there is active, visible protests and resistance, it goes to the point you made about four shows ago when you said the experiment showed that they can basically brainwash people very quickly with intimidation. No one will speak out against the obviously false narrative that's being said unless there's one guy who's stubborn. And if there's one stubborn person who's going, what are you talking about? It's blue. It's not red. It's a blue. If you get one stubborn person and then suddenly go, you know something? It is blue. Why did I think, you know, that's what we need. We need a million people to say, no, this is not real. This whole thing is a process to basically enslave us, and we're not going to have it.
Well, I think that's what happened with the one of the reasons for this, the civil unrest around the race issues, the stoking of a race war. And, you know, will there be a race war? No, because I don't think whites have the organization or the capability or the agency to even do that. But it's just to stir up that dispute. So the people, the narrative about COVID-19 was collapsing. All of a sudden, the focus shifts to the race riots and the protests. And all of a sudden, now there's this sort of the struggle session against all of white America, where now we're being told that we must feel guilty, we must pay reparations in one form or another, we must kneel. We have, you know, the spectacle of police chiefs and politicians and these things, almost universal. I'm not saying, and there's not one politician speaking up against the clear insanity of it all. That's a lot of this is just to humiliate the public to see things that are just absurd. And then be forced to accept it. And that's you know, someone posting a mild criticism on Black Lives Matter on social media can get fired, which is ridiculous. And since when is Black Lives Matter, which is a political institution or organization making demands, somehow immune from criticism? I mean, it's a radical organization. It's promoting radical homosexual transgender agendas. The two of the three founders are lesbian activists. You know, it's not an organization that should be immune from criticism at the very least. But what you do see, I mean, taking a couple of steps back, and you see all this these protests, it's clearly a fig leaf for a color revolution, as that term, what that term has come to mean, and it does bear a striking resemblance to all the CIA-backed coups, you know, launched over the, you know, past, you know, 75 years, 70 years, whatever. You know, just it seems to be applied to the United States now, and people who study these things kind of, they see the process. A good example is when you talk about the pallet of bricks being dropped off. And that's an interesting story, if true, because the same thing occurred in Egypt, where pallets of bricks were dropped off to for a supposed peaceful revolution. And so there's a logistical support here. And the thing is, the FBI could investigate this and probably find a criminal conspiracy, but they're not going to do that. Clearly you have an operation that's being carried out now. Look what we've been through.
Right.
Now, and you have, any day in America, in cities, there's going to be an incident with police and some black guy, given the way the police are and given how young black men are prone to crime. So there's always going to be someone falling asleep in a drive-thru at a Wendy's. He thinks it's the Burger King, and he resists arrest, starts pummeling the cops. They try to get him under control, and he gets shot and killed because he's pointing the taser at the person. Now this becomes a flashpoint for unrest, and now they're charging the police officer with murder. They're probably not going to get a conviction. I don't know. Maybe it will change by then. It would be so radical by then. They might. But the same thing with the case up in Minneapolis or anywhere. There's always an incident you can point out to highlight. And it depends on how the media wants to cover it. Media wants to come police shootings. Okay, fine. But let's talk about in one 24-hour period, there are 18 people murdered in Chicago, 85 people shot. I think all 18 murdered were black. Blacks killing blacks. They kill far more many. So why does the media focus on that? When you talk about whites needing to change their way of behavior, way of thinking, I'm not, I'm all for, self-criticism and introspection. That's fine. But if we look at the crime rates, look at the FBI crime statistics, I think Instagram now treats as hate speech because what it shows, obviously there is a exceedingly high rate of crime among blacks, particularly young black men. Shouldn't they be called upon to change their way of thinking, way of acting? A little balance here,
And what brought about the rap culture African-American male? I mean, where did this guy come from? He didn't exist in the 1950s. There was a culture that was
Jewish record label owners.
Yeah,
Jewish record companies.
This is where it comes from, and movies, with Shaft and all that. But these are not cultural elements that are owned by African Americans. Who owns all of these rap music, networks? They're always people from the outside. So this is, they have, when the authoritarian personality said we were going to use Eros, they had the first group that they were going to target with that were the blacks. Very first, they were going to go right after them because they knew that that was the most vulnerable part of America. Mm-hmm. And they also knew that they could then make them into idols and use those as cultural direction givers, right? So this was just
revolutionary proxy warriors.
Blacks
were the first.
So this is just as clear as a bell. And now when you see basically Black Lives Matter and some of these protests, you're just seeing like this long-standing project. But the thing is that if you really take the position of like, well, gee, we've got to do something about these terrible conditions that, that these black men are living under, black people are living under, you have to begin the process of trying to make it better by fixing the project that destroyed them and is destroying them. If you don't fix that, if you don't go back and revisit the Moynihan Report, what can you really offer?
Well, because that would reverse the ongoing revolution, the sexual revolution. That's all about atomization, the destruction of culture, the corruption of culture, and the destruction of community and family. Because they want to create the atomized individual that's a slave.
Right, exactly.
And the blacks are a great example of that. And then they can be used as a battering ram with the narrative of slavery in America's past. So that can be used as a battering ram against the dominant white culture. Any rule of law is not white supremacy. Although if we are living in a nation where there is white supremacy, explain to me how whites are now forced to grovel and kneel. doesn't make any sense. But Black Lives Matter movement, it clearly, because you see with the funding it's lavished with corporate funding, is that they are again tools of billionaire capitalists, and they're
Yeah,
being
it's
used,
not
you know.
the whole idea of white supremacy is ridiculous. I mean, we're the ones who go over the top and get slaughtered, war after war.
Yeah.
It's Masonic supremacy. That's what this is.
It's
If
like
you
blaming white people for slavery. You
exactly,
know.
if the
White
Irish
people?
are the Irish victims of white privilege,
Yeah.
you look at their look at the history of
Yeah, and then
that
you
capital.
have a protest over George Floyd, supposedly in Dublin, Ireland. What?
Well, it's just,
I
people
mean,
have become confused and discombobulated mentally, but
well, what this created is a generalized white or European guilt for all the problems in the world. And because the only problem is when you look at it, Caucasian or white people are make up less than 10% of the population. You know,
well, right,
yet the whole world wants to live in proximity to them because of the unique productivity and cultural and technological achievements of white civilization.
but if you look at like slavery the catastrophe of wars and all of these things that whites are held responsible for, white people weren't 1/10 of 1% of any of that. It wasn't us, it was the Masonic groups that did it. People have to flip the bit where they stop seeing a generalized, whiteness that is the cause of all of their misery. They have to start looking deeper and more clearly into the world and realizing, no, it's just this small group. And believe me, the Europeans, even though we are used or given as this supremacy and this white privilege, believe me, we are on the chopping block as much as anybody.
Well, a good
So.
example is in Great Britain, there's a statue of Winston Churchill that was vandalized. And again, it's vandalized because Winston Churchill is a white imperialist, as they'd say. But the thing is, they're vandalizing that statue for all the wrong reasons.
Right. I mean,
You know.
I would vandalize it if I could, but it would be for the right reasons, because he was a Masonic
Yeah.
lifetime actor whose purpose was to reduce European population. He was a pig. And so that's what you want to do
Well,
with.
they just see a statue with a white-looking guy on it, so they vandalize it. You know, the
Yeah.
mob doesn't think about these things, you know.
Now, Tim, I wanted to have there's a news a breaking news story here in Santa Barbara. I have my computer screen and there's a little thing that rings when something comes in, and I clicked on it just to see if I was expecting this other communication. And this is an incredible discovery, which is from the UCSB Bren School, and they have discovered that ultraviolet radiation has a statistically highly significant effect on the daily COVID-19 growth rates. In other words, sunshine turns out to like be something that reduced. I mean, gee whiz, we've been locked down for 4 months, and now they've made the like we have this high-tech, school come up with the idea that hey, sunlight, So this is how silly things have gotten, and it's just the way they characterize the world, a way like people who are involved in these protests, they don't they just fail to recognize that this is programming, that they have been coded just like Norbert Wiener back when the Macy Conference was thinking about how they could rule the world. They realize there are ways to code the minds of people. When you see the Black Lives Matter protesters and you see the white guilt-ridden associates in these things, they have been precisely coded. They've been precisely coded, just like Norbert Wiener said, and then just like was outlined in the authoritarian personality. And so we just have to break our programming so that our minds become free, so we can like see what's happening to us and resist.
It's an interesting story that I saw. I didn't get the details on it, but apparently there was either an online charity or GoFundMe type campaign to raise bail money for protesters slash rioters in Minneapolis. And I think it raised like $100 million, and it ended up forking out a few hundred thousand dollars for bail and keeping like 80% for administrative costs. So there's always an opportunity in these things to make a lot of money, isn't there?
Well, there always is. And, you know, it's like, you know, the when your army is basically heroin addicts, you really can't get the timing right on these like precise kind of military operations, you know, because just go in the wrong direction. And so this is, you know, and then at the top they steal everything. And so it's, you know, we don't really have anything to fear from, you know.
Well, yeah, look at Wall Street got away with, you know, trillions of dollars. And look, guys, a race war.
Yeah, look over there. There's a race war going on. Look, be careful. There's a virus. It's right on top of you. You know, don't mind us when we take everything. So, you know, we have been mistrained. We have been coded to basically be gullible, to be without the capacity for self-defense, self-esteem. I mean, these things have all been put in our minds. And the good news is, is that the human mind is very resilient. And all we have to do is just wake up. We don't have to do much. We just have to realize, oh my gosh, it's all an illusion. And I am being attacked. These people are not my friends. This isn't the real history of what happened to my people. And then they can defend themselves. I mean, if the Irish people would understand the Irish Holocaust and the Irish slave trade, they would be a lot more able to resist the propaganda that the people control Black Lives Matter are trying to bring into Ireland at this point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, Joe.
Tim, I hope you have a great weekend. And I think we'll get them next week. And this is going to be a really exciting show because God knows where the country will be in a week.
Might be renamed by then. So there.
Yeah, that's could be very possible. So powers and principalities will rise up from the ashes. All right, brother.
Okay, have a great weekend. Take it easy. Bye-bye.
Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.